Hi, Patrick Cox with The World in Words, and a very special podcast this week. Esperanto. 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 Esperanto estas. They won't give up, those Esperanto speakers, and there's a good reason why. Unlike hundreds of other invented languages, Esperanto is still alive more than a century after its birth. A history of invented languages today, why people are drawn to them, why they fail, and what they teach us about natural language. Our guide is Erica Okrent, and she is dedicated. She went to a Klingon convention, you know, where they don't just speak Klingon, they dress up as Klingons.
I shrank in my seat as an exceptionally polite waitress patiently guessed at what my costumed table mates were pointing to when they insisted on giving their orders in Klingon. Later, as the group made its rubber-foreheaded, vinyl-gloved, wool-caped, guttural Klingon-speaking way toward the door, I saw a table of cute teenage girls mouthing a silent chorus of, "Oh my God."
As a free man, I take pride in the word, "Ich bin ein Violiner."
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
Absolute, the biggest load of chicken droppings I've heard in a long time, Jeremy, I have to say.
The World Public Radio Show is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The Big Show is broadcast on more than 280 public radio stations around the United States. You can listen online or at theworld.org. That's also where you can check out all of our podcasts, other places to find us. We're on Facebook, at the World in Words group page. I'm also on Twitter. Today's show, including our sideways meal, is entirely dedicated to invented languages. And the reason for this is simple. Invented languages are fascinating. And, well, maybe I speak for myself here, but the more I hear about them, the more I want to hear. And I'm no geek when it comes to invented languages. I don't know a single word of Esperanto. I'd far prefer to expend the few brain cells I have left on other pursuits. That said, as you'll hear, many of the languages people have dreamed up over the years tell us a whole bunch about our own natural languages. They tell us about how we think and how we don't think, and about how we tend to blame language for everything. Okay, before I introduce our guest, let's get in the swing of things with a blast of a couple of invented languages. Here's some Esperanto.
Esperanto eniris en mian vivon tute hazarde.
En mia universitato mi vidis afiŝon.
Mi trovis estis Esperanto. Kaj mi diris, oh, mi konas tion.
And now, Klingon.
Klingon foliage karma, shuwe kowijar. Klingon foliage karma, rekut lechtach bar. Kok me posh mochol.
I think if I were actually in the presence of those people performing that song, I would be rendered speechless for an incredibly long time. Erica Okrent is the author of A History of Invented Languages that's just come out. It's called In the Land of Invented Languages, Esperanto Rockstars, Klingon Poets, and Mad Dreamers Who Tried to Build a Perfect Language. To give you a sense of how she's written about this subject, here is her bio on the book flap. Erica Okrent received a joint PhD in the Department of Linguistics and the Department of Psychology's Cognition and Cognitive Neuroscience program at the University of Chicago. She has also earned her first level certification in Klingon. I think she's equally proud of both accomplishments. Here is our interview. It's a long one, and for good reason. Erica Okrent, welcome to The World in Words. And I have to say right now that the main reason that I invited you on was because several of the podcast listeners demanded it. I think it was about halfway through. I was about halfway through your book when I relented and I realized it would be a really good idea to talk to you.
Well, thank you, people out there.
And I think that the reason I was initially reluctant to interview you was because Well, first, I've had kind of a bad experience with overzealous Esperanto enthusiasts. So I was trying to keep them at bay a little bit. And I developed, I have to admit, a little bit of a prejudice against Esperanto speakers. And the other reason was because, let's face it, there's a bit of a freak show aspect to this world. And I wasn't initially convinced that there was that much to learn about real languages here. But now I've read the book, I'm the first to admit that I'm wrong. And I wonder, when you started your research on this book, if you had similar qualms yourself.
Well, the reason I started with the book is that it came from this feeling of, why do people do this? I would find these little pamphlets and self-published books in the library, and I thought it was so obviously clear that this was crazy that people do this, invent these languages. Why do they think it's going to work? And as I got into it and learned more about it and got into the communities who actually do practice with these invented languages, it made me think a lot more deeply about natural languages and why they do work and why it's so difficult to quote-unquote cure natural languages. You can learn about a lot about why they're incurable by looking at the people who have tried to solve all the problems with language.
Right. I mean, is it a different kind of person who does the solving as opposed to studies organic real languages that are out there? Do these attract different types of people?
Well, I think if you want to invent a language to solve some problem with natural language, to make it better, more logical, less ambiguous, it sort of shows that you have very little understanding of natural languages and how or why they work. There's this attitude going into creating a language that's this, why has no one thought of this before? Let's build a better language. And if you know a bit about how languages do work, natural languages, then it's probably more obvious to you why that's not a good idea. It's sort of like, you study languages all your life, you come to have great respect for all the weird things that languages do, and that becomes the fun part of it. And for someone to come in and say, let's tamp down on those crazy parts of language and make it something very rational and predictable. So it shows you have quite a different attitude about language.
And then you have these other languages, and let's bring up Klingon right now. I mean, you have these other languages that have been created almost with a very kind of whimsical, let's make it as difficult and complicated as possible. So, you know, it's in a way, something like Klingon is almost riffing off of how difficult, really difficult languages are.
Yeah, languages like Klingon or like the modern Conlangs, these artistic languages that people create, have quite the opposite reasoning behind them. They're sort of testaments of love for language and the strange and inconsistent things they do. So Klingon collects all the most exotic features from natural languages and uses a totally bizarre and rare word order and sounds that you wouldn't normally find together in natural languages and mixes them all up into something that's coherent to a linguist. It looks like something that could possibly exist, but something that would be very strange to find in nature.
Well, you start the book and you end it with scenes among speakers of Klingon. We should maybe just point out at this point that Klingon, where it came from, is Star Trek. It was conceived by a linguist who was contracted by Star Trek to do this. So this is, you know, non-human characters speaking on a screen in a fantasy, in a sci-fi fantasy. And lo and behold, people who are watching this, people in largely in America, who have taken Klingon on and they're running with it. They have conventions and they have exams. And you joined them. You went to a Klingon convention. So people around you were not only speaking Klingon, but in some cases they were dressed up as Klingons, as monster-type warriors. And it was at that convention that you took a Klingon proficiency exam. And I wonder if you'd read an excerpt from the book about that.
Yeah, this was my experience studying for this Klingon exam, which I wasn't expecting to do when I went into it, but I got drawn in by the challenge of it. So I had to learn 500 words really quickly when I got there, and I made flashcards. So flip, 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 the flashcards flashed. In my room at night, while everyone else hung out at the pool, I sorted them into piles of 10, only moving on to the next pile when I had one fully memorized. In the lobby, after the sing-along and before Klingon Pictionary, I had people quiz me. At the old spaghetti factory, while we waited for a table for 18, I badgered Louise, who frankly didn't seem to be studying hard enough, into reciting my intra-Klingon word associations with me. Wiv, tiv, yiv, choose, enjoy, chew. I choose to enjoy to chew. By the afternoon of the test, I was feeling burned out. My head was swimming with what were essentially useless nonsense words. And some of the Klingons were getting on my nerves. Did they have to be so weird? Did they have to be so weird in public? At a small Thai restaurant that we practically took over during the lunch rush, I shrank in my seat as an exceptionally polite waitress patiently guessed at what my costumed table mates were pointing to when they insisted on giving their orders in Klingon. I wanted to meet her gaze and apologize with my eyes, but she was too rattled by the experience to look my way. Later, as the group made its rubber-foreheaded, vinyl-gloved, wool-caped, guttural Klingon-speaking way toward the door, with me ineffectively hiding behind my hair, I saw a table of cute teenage girls mouthing a silent chorus of, "Oh my God." I have to say, it stung.
Wow, thanks very much. I mean, you do not shy away from the freak show aspect of this in that description. But you also, in many parts of the book, mount a very spirited defense of people who do learn these languages.
Yeah, I found it very strange of the angry reaction they get from people. Why are you studying this crazy made-up language when you could be studying a real language? Why are you wasting your time with this? We waste our time doing all kinds of things. And this is just another creative endeavor, a way for people to socialize with each other, doing something interesting with language. It certainly is interesting, whether or not it's useful for anything. And I got to say, I gained a bit of respect for just the sheer bravery it takes to do this and not care what anyone thinks of you. We could all use a little bit more of that.
You ended up at the end of the book listing 500 inventive languages and suggesting that there are many hundreds more, although it's almost impossible to actually list them out exhaustively because many of them are sort of partial languages. Mm-hmm. But what's clear is that people have been inventing languages going back many hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's documented at least as far back as Hildegard von Bingen in 1150 and probably before then.
Probably as long as there has been language, there's been people trying to fiddle with it and improve upon it.
And the reason why people have felt this need to not just fiddle but dream up these new tongues has changed somewhat over time, even if at the root there is the belief that conventional language has, in one way or another, has failed us. Take us through some of those different motivations.
Well, the first sort of heyday in language invention was in the 17th century, and the primary example of a language of this time was John Wilkins, a founding member of the Royal Society. He created this philosophical language where he sort of broke down the universe into its component concepts so that you could then make a word that perfectly represented the concept. So the word itself, the sounds in the word, told you exactly what the word meant. And there were lots of these languages being created at that time because mathematical notation was on the rise then. People were figuring out ways to represent information with this new kind of notation. People used to do mathematics in paragraph form. And when you put them into equations with variables, you can get insights that you can't otherwise see when you have it in a language in paragraph form. So people thought, well, if we can do this for mathematics and solve the mysteries of the universe, there was definitely this feeling during the scientific revolution that the mysteries of the universe were being solved this way. Maybe we could do this for language and speak in this manner, and then the truth would be known in every exchange, in our communication. And so the challenge was on to create a language that sort of worked like mathematical notation and could expose the truths of the universe. Wilkins' project was the most extensively thought out and most successful of any of them. But after his death, people sort of forgot about it and it never went anywhere, mostly because it's just too difficult to speak that way in perfect concepts.
Right. There's this search for perfection, and we're not perfect. And also, we don't necessarily think in this kind of ultra logical, and I mean logical at the time, way.
Yeah, you have to know, in Wilkins' language, you have to know exactly what concept you want in order to create the word for that concept. And when we talk to each other, we often have a very fuzzy idea of what we're trying to talk about, and we just sort of forge ahead, and we get meaning created that way. And it works a lot better if we have those fuzzy edges and that ambiguity to just communicate with each other. But it was a really amazing and document of what people thought, how people thought the universe was organized in the 17th century. It sort of faded. It faded out over the course of the next century. There was still a couple that popped up here and there. But the invented language idea revived at the end of the 19th century in a much more practical form, when the pressing problems of the day weren't so much philosophical and scientific as the rise of nationalism. People who spoke different languages weren't getting along, and there was now the steam engine, the telegraph. People could move around and communicate with each other a lot more easily, and people started to think we needed a better tool for doing that. But not a perfect tool, a tool that was easy for everybody to learn, so that we could have this lingua franca with no irregularities, with consistent spelling and pronunciation that we could then use to bring the world together and bring peace to the world. And Esperanto was the primary example of this drive behind language invention.
Which is funny. I mean, as you say, the primary drive, there were several of them. Esperanto is considered within the world of invented languages as a success, although it is a success only when measured up against the hundreds of other attempts at invented languages that have failed. But what were the original goals of Esperanto? Was it really for a universal language, or was it for a universal diplomatic language or a universal trade language? Or was it really for everybody of all strata to speak the language?
According to Ludwig Zamenhof, the inventor, it was for humanity, for all humanity. And there were plenty of other languages at the time that had a more practical goal. It was for commerce or for education. Here's my perfect language and here's why it will be useful to you. But he presented his language not by saying, here's why it will be useful to you, but he put it forth along with a sort of a culture. So in his original book on it, he had some examples of letters you might write or poetry that you could write, songs in Esperanto. And people were attracted not just to the language, but to the culture that sprung up around Esperanto, like-minded people who believed in peace and brotherhood and wanted to promote it. They found each other and created these Esperanto songs and poems and plays and had conventions. And it wasn't so much that they found it really useful or a really great tool. It's that it allowed them to find each other and create a culture which still exists to this day, in spite of what lots of people think.
And what was it then that Esperanto had going for it as a language that the others didn't?
Well, partially it was the luck of timing. So it came right on the heels of another project, Volapük, which had a certain amount of success but had fallen apart with infighting between the people who wanted to improve it further or change it. And so when Esperanto came along, there was this community of people already built up who then looked and switched to Esperanto. So there was a little action going already. Zamenhof didn't have to start from scratch. And it was also this age, you know, the late 19th century was the age of great optimism for grand social engineering experiments. So people really thought, not just with language, but with lots of things, that you could design a society and sort of impose it from above and say, here, this will bring everybody together. This will make life work better. This will make our own community. And Esperanto was a part of that. People believed in that. And then also the fact that it became a culture that could perpetuate itself. So it's artificial in the beginning, but after time, this artificial songs and hymns and rigmarole that's set into the whole system of conventions and Esperanto-style meetings became entrenched, and it became the way of being Esperanto. And, you know, forced tradition plus time equals real tradition. So it's a culture of its own now, not a human language, a universal language, but the language of the Esperanto people, I guess you'd call them.
And that also means that presumably certain words have changed meaning, maybe spelling. Esperanto today presumably is a very different language from how it was originally conceived.
Yeah, once you give your language over to people to use it, they're going to do what humans do with language and create idioms and expressions that, you know, you can figure out Esperanto with a dictionary a little more easily than you can with a natural language. But there's still going to be plenty of expressions that you just need to learn, and that you once you become part of the Esperanto culture, you learn how to say things in a more Esperanto-y way rather than a textbook Esperanto way. It still works as a textbook language. You can get into it pretty easily, but it's a human language that humans are using. It's not going to stay terribly tidy.
Do you happen to have any examples off the top of your head of phrases that have transformed over time?
Well, there's a phrase, when you say goodbye, you say gis, which means until. The original expression was gis la rivideo, until the re-seeing of each other. And that got shortened to gis la, so people will say gis la for goodbye. And then that got shortened to gis. You know, if you look gis up in a dictionary, you find until. You don't find goodbye. But, you know, the Esperantists know that it means goodbye. So you have to learn that. You can't necessarily look it up in the dictionary.
I also wanted, just almost by way of comparison, even though it's a very, very different type of language, to bring up another language that had some partial success but was also hindered somewhat because its founder was very opposed to the way in which it was being used, and that is Bliss Symbolics. Can you tell us a little bit about this language and about the man who invented it, Charles Bliss?
Well, Charles Bliss was an Austrian Jew who had been interred in a concentration camp but then released, and he escaped to Shanghai. And there he saw Chinese writing and became entranced by it and fascinated. And he thought, if you could make a language that represented ideas in a pictographic way, you could avoid things like propaganda. You couldn't manipulate people with a language of pictographic symbols because it would be so obvious what it meant. You couldn't do what the Nazis did or what the Soviets were doing with propaganda. And he had this grand idea to create this symbol language, which he worked on for years and years, toiling in obscurity, desperate to get someone to pay attention to him, sending out 6,000 letters to all the universities of the world, to the governments of the world. And finally, in the 70s, a school for children with cerebral palsy in Canada found a mention of his system because they were looking for a way to help children who couldn't speak learn to use language. They couldn't move, they couldn't talk. How could you teach them to spell and read? You needed something else, an intermediate system. And so they began to use his symbol system, and he was overjoyed at first. He had finally been discovered. He had finally been recognized. But he quickly became angry when he saw that they weren't treating it as a universal language or as a language of logic and truth. They were treating it as a tool to help children learn English. And he started squabble after squabble with them and threatened lawsuits. And it all finally ended in a big lawsuit where they had to pay him to stop impeding the progress of their program. And sort of a tragic story, because once he finally got the recognition he wanted, he ruined it by interfering too much. And it's still used a bit today, but he definitely destroyed the chances for it as a major system of therapy.
Right. These letters that he wrote were just horrible. And I mean, almost from the very beginning, I didn't have a good feeling about how this story was going to unfold because he named the language after himself.
Yes. In the history of invented languages, there have been many. He's sort of the prototypical crazy language inventor. He's got these delusions of grandeur. While he talks about setting out to make the world a better place, you know he's got that Nobel Prize in his sight lines and riches and fame. And many who have set out to create a better language have harbored these ideas that it would make them famous and wealthy, and it would be such a boon to humanity that they would then go down in history as the greatest inventor ever. And Bliss had that syndrome to a pretty high degree.
There's another great one that I had a real, real soft spot for, and that is the woman's language. How do you say it? Ladan?
Ladan, yes.
Ladan. I laughed out loud when you described it as, what did you say, it has the only language textbook that gives the word for menstruate in lesson one.
Yeah.
And not only is it to menstruate, then you learn that there's a word for to menstruate joyfully, to menstruate for the first time, to menstruate painfully, to menstruate early, to menstruate late. And, you know, I just thought that there's got to be a place in the world for a language like that.
Yeah, I mean, in English, we're so limited in the way we can talk about menstruation, right? So, you know, clearly, you know, there's a lot of aspects of this language that relate to women's bodily experiences, but there's also aspects of it that are a little more subtle, I guess you'd say. You have to say the intention of your speech act before you say it so that there isn't these misunderstandings that go, you know, why did you say that? Hey, I was just kidding. No, you weren't. You didn't use the just kidding particle before you stated your sentence. And so that's seen as a useful thing in a woman's perspective, I guess. But yeah, it's a very interesting language, and it goes way beyond, you know, spelling women with a Y or, you know, the question of gender neutral pronouns. It's got a lot of interesting thought experiment features to it. If we talk this way, will we be more conscious of women's perspective and women's experience?
In all of the languages that you have learned, either real or invented, what have you found most instructive about the real ones versus the inventive ones? And, you know, has learning invented languages helped you understand language itself?
Well, it has, in that learning these invented languages and trying to really take seriously the ideas behind them is very instructive in figuring out why natural languages have all these messy inconsistencies that we aren't going to talk in a perfectly logical system because that's not suited to what we need to do with language. Languages, we can be very specific and clear when we speak, or we can be kind of messy and sloppy, and we need both ends of that continuum. And so, you know, I don't have this sense that we need to cure language, and because language needs the flaws that it has. You know, but I do have respect for these artistic languages and the way they play with ideas. What if you had a language that combined these features that we've, you know, as of yet not found combined in natural languages? Or what if you had a language, there's one that tries to imagine what English would look like as a romance language. It's just kind of a parlor game, but you have to know a lot about language history in order to create one of these things and make it look good and consistent. And those little artistic thought experiments can be very interesting, even if you're adamantly pro-natural language and against invented languages.
Yeah, yeah, as you say, very sophisticated, some of these. So sophisticated, in fact, that they have examples of poor grammar, lots of them. So there is such a thing as bad Klingon.
Yes, and there's dialect differences in Klingon, and there's grammatical mistakes that have reasons behind them. Yeah, Klingon is intentionally sloppy because it's supposed to be realistic.
Now, wait a minute. The dialect differences, are the dialect differences of this Earth or of wherever it is the Klingon people come from?
Well, they're generally inspired by the fact that it was very difficult to get the actors on the show to pronounce things correctly.
Oh, right.
So it's sort of back explaining away why it might be said this way. Oh, that's a dialect difference. But it's okay, right, because languages have those, right?
Do you have a favorite invented language?
I don't know. I have my favorite inventors. I have a soft spot for Fuikishi Okamoto, the inventor of Boabamu. His was one of the first books that I found in the library, sitting there all lonely on the shelf. And he wanted to create this language of peace and perfect philosophy. But his example sentences are so sort of endearing and sad. Things like, he has not met his original goal, and I choose a healthful meal rather than a delicious one. And he talks about how much he suffered, and how he was born a weak baby. And in one sense, the language looks very silly, but in another, here's a person who seems very nice and who struggled his whole life and didn't get anywhere with it. And I found it very hard to laugh with ridicule after I got into his life a little more.
That's a good way of looking at it as well, having a favorite inventor. How do you keep up with your Esperanto right now, or Klingon, or any of these other languages?
Well, I don't keep up with it too well. I have dictionary Esperanto or dictionary Klingon, so I can... Esperanto is pretty easy to fake it with if you know something about European languages. I can read it, I can understand it, but it's harder for me to produce it because when I'm trying to think of the word I want to say, I'm never quite sure, is it going to be a Romance root or a Germanic root, or maybe it's even an English word, and you have to choose the right one when you're coming out with it. But when you hear it, you say, oh yes, of course. Birdo is bird. Where if I'm trying to speak it, I'll probably pick something like avo or some root like that.
Erica Okrent. Her new book is called In the Land of Invented Languages, and it's a great read. We just have time for Eating Sideways. That's the segment where we pick a foreign word or phrase that's not easily translatable into English. Of course, this week it has to be from an invented language. Here's one of Erica Okrent's favorites.
There's one from Ladan, the woman's language. The word is rathom, non-pillow, one who lures another to trust and rely on him or her, but has no intention of following through, a lean-on-me-so-I-can-step-aside-and-let-you-fall person. I guess this is one of the words you, from a woman's perspective, you would think would be handy. There's also rathu, non-guest, someone who comes to visit knowing perfectly well that he or she is intruding and causing difficulty.
We all know that person, right? Strange there isn't a term for it in English. Thank you, Ladan. Please send me your comments and suggestions. The email address is language@pri.org, or post something on the World in Words Facebook group page. We're taking you out here with some Esperanto, and see you next week.
Del sum de Ipanema por baixo sabença chai na de poema cai se chico que sumas me gemas por mim.